So this is the second day of this retreat on the mind trainings. And we all know that time, the experience of time is subjective. So when I say second day, it really feels like we've been doing this for a while. I mean, in a good way. It doesn't seem like, I don't know, it just seems like, oh. So that's good. Time has kind of slowed down. Many things happen in a day. Just want to say for those who have had their interviews already, if things come up in your practice, you run into obstacles, or you have some sort of experience that you don't quite understand, again, please feel free to write a note to me, and you put it in the bell, and it will come to me. So, again, I won't use your name, so you don't have to worry about that. But I will do my best to address any issues that come up for you. Also, obviously, this is the cold flu season in Florida, as probably in the rest of the country. And since we inter are, for the good things and the not so good things, this is something we need to be aware of. And obviously, the doing the things, just to be very careful when our hands touch and things like that often can help that we do not share it too much. But also, it is a good time to practice for those who are sick. Because you might notice that when one gets sick or ill or has any kind of debilitating thing going on in their body, life kind of narrows. And there is a tendency to see, to be kind of self-absorbed with our symptomology, rather than just being aware of the symptoms and, bearing them with good cheer. And so even if we may not be up to par, having had a head cold recently, I can understand there is a little fogginess, kind of an energetic thing that goes on. It doesn't mean that our awareness is still not here, and that we still do not have the capability of absorption of Dharma and teaching. So please please remember that. And again, it is a good time to reflect on impermanence and how, as Thich Nhat Hanh says, how little we value our health and well-being until we get sick. Then we miss it terribly. But when we have it, we take it for granted. So for those of us who are not sick today, please be grateful for that. And for those who are sick, understand that, or those who are not sick, you see those who are sick, even though there's a certain kind of happiness in not being sick and seeing the sicknesses in others. that is unfortunately the way the ego deals with thing. Please understand, because of the nature of impermanence and interbeing, our time may be next. So do not gloat. it may come home to haunt us. But also, again, we will be getting into the alchemical exchange of self and other, taking on the sufferings of others. But for those within this practice community that are not feeling good or are sick, reflect on that and to be aware there are many, 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 many millions and millions and millions or hundreds of millions of people, if not more, who are sick right now too. And, it is very easy for us to want ourselves to get well, to have good wishes for ourselves. but it's also good to have good wishes that everybody who is sick would be healthy again. Again, we need to retrain this mind of ours to think beyond itself. So, again, this is the second day of this intensive or retreat. And so there we were yesterday in the preliminaries. And I realized afterwards, I just mentioned it, but then I talked about that preliminary with the teacher over the head, but I didn't read it. So let me just read it. Again, this is not me. This is Jamyang Kongtrul, and this is the tradition. So you imagine your teacher, and again, you can imagine your teacher in a human form, or you can imagine your teacher in the form of a Buddha or a Bodhisattva, anything. It's like there's this emotional connection. Seated on a lotus moon above your head, his or her body is radiant, happy, smiling, as he regards all beings with non-referential compassion. And in him or her are all the root and lineage gurus are present. Again, that could be sort of a conceptual trick, but it's true. None of us are solid, permanent, self-existing thing. All of us are made up of parts, and all of us have who we are because of endless variables which are making us up right now. There's nothing even solid in us right now. We are just filled with lots of characteristics and tendencies, impressions that we have consciously or unconsciously absorbed over our lifetime. So therefore, anybody who has studied and practiced under a teacher, that obviously it gets internalized, right? And so therefore, in a certain way, all of us, in a certain way, in a very real way, are representative of all the effects. We are the effects of all the causes. And if our teachers have developed many, many causes that has affected our mind and our speech and our actions, they are present within us. But of course, where did they get it from? Well, they got it from their teachers. So you see, it goes back and back and back. And we can see that it is not too much of a logical leap to actually see that all the good qualities in our teachers come from preceding teachers, and that go all the way back to the Buddha. So it is true that in the presence of our teacher, the imagination, we are in the presence of the lineage and the transmission. So then with intense respect and devotion, repeat a prayer 100 or 1,000 times. And what they say here is, I pray for your blessing, my teacher, great and completely worthy spiritual friend. I pray that you will cause love, compassion, and bodhicitta to arise in my mind. It's a nice prayer, isn't it? Kind of, you see, at the beginning of a meditation, it kind of reminds us, oh, this is what it's about. See, we forget what it's about, and we think we're doing, I got to sit down and do my meditation. Right? I got to do this practice. I got to work on this technique. But that's all in the service of what? That love, compassion, and bodhicitta will arise in my mind. Do you see that? So by stating that, it's making it very obvious. And then it says, imagine that your teacher descends through the top of your head, sits in your heart in a pavilion of light like an open shell. And it says, it is important to begin every period of meditation this way. So that is what it is said here in this text. Then when it begins the preliminaries, as we went over yesterday, after introducing them, and again, these are very short here, and Jamyang Kongtrul does make reference to other texts for more further explanation, because his is very brief, and so that's certainly true for all of us. And when we know those who've been in the intensive, they're very wonderful commentaries and explanations of these four preliminary practices, these four mind-turning thoughts that turn the mind to Dharma elsewhere. But then he says, you need to work at these contemplations so that they definitely become part of your thinking. Okay? So for people who wonder, well, what am I supposed to do with these? How much do I practice them? Okay? This is what he says. We need to get over and over until they become part of our thinking. Everybody know what their thinking is? Right? That thing that just continues all day? We want these contemplations to become part of that. Right? So if your mind, as it is wont to do, is always looking for things to think about, right? Rather than thinking about the things we usually think about, let's think about these four thoughts. That's what he's saying. Right? We want to change this mind. We wonder why we practice, we go to retreat, we come to Sangha, we do this and we that, but yet our mind does not change. It is because we have not allowed Dharma to merge with our minds. Right? So these teachers are spoon-feeding us. Right? They're taking the Dharma and they're putting it on a little spoon and saying, here, take this thought into your mind. Right? Because left to our own, we just read it, go on to the next page. Right? And think about what? This one or that one. This worry, this, you know. So he's telling us, you got to think about these things. You don't only have to think about them when you're on retreat. Right? You can think about them when you're home. You can think about them when you're going about the world. Oh, impermanence. Oh, impermanence. Oh, change, change, change. Oh, the suffering of samsara, the dissatisfaction. Yeah, when you hear this or read this or think this, oh, there it is. Oh, cause and effect. Climate change, cause and effect. War, cause and effect. Aggression, cause and effect. Greed, cause and effect. So you're using these teachings to view, think about life, your life, other life, life differently. There's got to be a change. If you're just reading Dharma, studying Dharma, talking Dharma, but when you look at your mind, it's same old, what does that tell you? Hasn't gotten where it needs to get. Right? What do they say when you take the pill? Take this with a full glass of water. Why do they say that? Not just a little thimble of water. Why do they say take a full glass of water with it?
So it's absorbed.
Got to get inside there so it can work its magic. Right? Dharma's got to, you got to take it with a full, it's got to get in there. Right? Just take the pill and let it slosh around in your mouth. And then he kind of goes through them, as I said, very briefly. And then at the end of the section, he says, you should energetically train yourself in this kind of thinking. Okay, is that clear? It's a training. We should energetically train ourselves. Train means repetition, 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 over and over again. We reflect and we notice. Again, as we go about the world, the reality of these mind turnings. And then he says, at the end of every period of meditation, perform the seven-branch prayer as many times as you are able. In post-meditation means when you get up from your cushion and you go about the world, put the points of your reflections into practice. So you can see, always about practice. Now, does everybody know what the seven-branch prayer is? Seven-branch prayer is a very traditional kind of prayer that is often said sort of at the end of a practice period, the beginning of a practice period. And it really, for those of you familiar with the Shanti Deva and the Path of the Bodhisattva, it's really almost taken word from word from one of the early chapters. So let me just share with you, it is in this The Great Path of Awakening, it is in the back. It's very traditional. So for those of you who are not used to traditional Buddhism, you may, you may this or that. But anyhow, this is what it is. With complete faith, I bow to all the victorious ones and their sons who abide in the 10 directions and the 3 times. Pride. We don't like to bow, do we? We like it when people bow to us. We wouldn't mind that, would we? But we don't give our bows away easily. We are prideful people. So, are there things worth paying respect to? That's really what this is about. I bow to all the victorious ones, their sons and daughters, who abide in the 10 directions and the 3 times. So, yeah. To those, I will lower the mast of ego, humble myself before them, because they are what? They are the victorious ones. They are victorious over delusion. Right? You know, in our own country, when there's a military victory and the troops come home, what is there? A big parade. Right? To honor the ones who have been victorious in battle. But in Buddhism, in this life, there is another kind of battle. That's really more important than needs to be won. Right? And so we respect those. We pay homage to those who have been victorious. The next verse says, I offer flowers, incense, light, perfume, food, music, and many other things, both in substance and with my imagination. I ask the noble assemblage to accept them. This one's about greed. We have no problem lighting some incense, some scented candles in our own home, do we? We like it. We offer ourselves flowers. We offer ourselves food. We put on beautiful music, don't we? Kind of music we like, right? We have no problem offering all the beautiful things that we enjoy to who? To ourselves. And maybe a few other people that we include in our little universe. So this goes, I offer everything precious, everything beautiful, everything that I have of my own and everything that I could possibly imagine. I offer it to the noble assemblage. I let go, and I understand all the beautiful things of the world are really to benefit others. And that community of awakened ones who are ceaselessly working to liberate others, you know, I want you to have all the beautiful things. I offer them to you. So this is about generosity, to overcome this greediness that the self has. And the strange thing about greediness is, you know, it's kind of exponential with how much we have. You would think when you have more, you'd be less greedy because you have more. But we know that the more people have, the greedier they become. It's kind of counterintuitive, but in a certain way, unfortunately, it does have a rationale. Third, I confess all evil actions that I've done, influenced by the defilements from time without beginning until now, the five that ripen immediately, the ten non-virtuous actions, and many others. The five are like the really bad ones. You know, they ripen immediately, you know, killing a Buddha or something, or killing your mother or something, you know. They're five that are really bad, immediate downfall. And they're the ten, you know, the ten trainings that we do. Well, we do five, but in other traditions there are ten. But anyhow, so confession is a willingness to acknowledge openly that we act and have acted and continue to act unskillfully and in the service of our own ego and self. We cause suffering to others, or we miss opportunities to alleviate suffering to others, as well as ourselves. Okay? So this is an open acknowledgement. Right? It's a statement, we could say, of our desire to be a nonviolent people. Right? I confess, I acknowledge all my acts, where through words or actions of body or thought, where I have, where I act aggressively toward other human beings. Okay. I rejoice in the merit of whatever virtue Shravakas, Pratika Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, and ordinary people gather throughout the three times. So this is taking joy in the joy of others. This is the opposite of envy, jealousy, right? Where we go, oh. Other people who do good deeds, other people who act virtuously, great beings and ordinary beings. I take joy in them. I'm happy. When I hear about it, it makes me happy. Is that clear? It's the opposite of this envy or jealousy, you know. Why me? Or always looking for fault, or, you know, it must be something. They must be up to something. How come I'm not getting the applause? Taking joy in the joy of others. I pray for I pray for the wheel of the Dharma to be turned, the teachings of the Mahayana and the Hinayana in ways suitable for different aptitudes and motivations present in sentient beings. So this is acknowledging the need, myself, everyone, that the teachings be present in the world. I pray for the wheel of Dharma. You know, it's called the Dharma wheel. The first sutra of the Buddha that he gave at Sarnath is called the turning of the Dharma wheel. The Dharma wheel became a symbol of Buddhism. It took what was the royal symbol of power and war, the chariot wheel, right? The wheel of power over, the wheel of aggression, and created a Dharma wheel. The eight spokes of the Dharma wheel are the Eightfold Path. So, I pray, you know, that this wheel of Dharma be turned. Teachings of Mahayana, Hinayana, all the teachings, because they're all speak to the various aptitudes and motivations of all types of sentient beings, including myself. I pray that they, I know they're needed. Please, keep turning that wheel. Six, I ask the Buddhas not to pass into parinirvana, into nirvana, but with great compassion, until samsara is completely empty, to look after sentient beings who drown in this ocean of sorrow. So Buddhas, Bodhisattvas are not permanent entities, teachers, right? We know they're impermanent. So we ask them, stay here. You know, I know you'd probably like a rest somewhere. Hang out in one of the heavens for Tushita Heaven or somewhere for a couple of lifetimes just to rest. But please don't. There's a lot of work here. Beings are suffering. Please stay until samsara is completely empty. Samsara will never be completely empty. But yet we ask the Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas, stay here. And finally, the seventh, may whatever merit I have accumulated become a seed for the enlightenment of all beings without delay. May I become a splendid leader for sentient beings. That's what we were talking about last night, right? In response to Gunther's question, right? So here it is. Whatever merit, if I've done any good deeds, good deeds in terms of benefiting others, good deeds in terms of spiritual practices, may they become a seed for the enlightenment of all beings, right? And without delay, may I become a splendid leader for sentient beings. Here's the vow. Here's the great vow of the Bodhisattva, right? Which we, in all our miserable, egocentric, neurotic, we make. I want to become a splendid, what a great, you know, a splendid leader for sentient beings. Right? Somebody's got to lead them in another direction. Right? Because if you pay attention to the what the leaders the leaders of this world, where they're trying to take sentient beings, right? It's not a place that will produce goodness, will it? No. The worldly leaders want to take human beings continually down a road of war and aggression and greed and self-interest, even though from time to time they do do some good things. But underlying it all so much, unfortunately, these days, is this total self-interest. Right. We need new leaders. Where are they going to come from? They have to come from us. Us, not just only us. The us, the bigger us of human beings who see another way for this world, for life, for relationships. So without delay, may I become a splendid leader for sentient beings. So that's a seven-limb prayer. And he recommends that at the end of every period of meditation that we recite it as many If you say, well, how many times should I recite it? He says, as many times as you're able. So if you're retired and have a lot of time on your hands, thousands and tens of thousands. Okay, so we are turning the page, and we are into the next page, which is now the second of the seven, which is called the actual practice, training in bodhicitta. Training in bodhicitta. Bodhicitta has many shades of meaning, but its most direct is training in the enlightened mind. Right? Bodhi is the mind of a Buddha. It's the mind of awakening. Citta is mind. So bodhi is this wisdom, awakenedness of citta, mind. It also includes all the training and aspiration to achieve this awakened mind. So it's both and. So he says, as for the second point, there are two sections in the actual practice, the associated meditation on ultimate bodhicitta and the principal meditation on relative bodhicitta, which is interesting. So the associated, and we'll get into the associated meditation on ultimate bodhicitta. Right, the wisdom, the direct knowing, the nature of reality, the nature of mind, which is, you know, the two wings of the bodhisattva, the wing of compassion, the wing of wisdom, prajna and upaya. But he calls ultimate bodhicitta associated one. And the relative bodhicitta, which is primarily meaning the exchange of self and other, the alchemical exchange, he calls that the principal one. Is that clear? That is how much the importance and the centrality of compassion and loving kindness is to this path. And that the insight, the meditative insight that comes by plunging the depths of the mind is associated to that development. Is that clear? It's associated, it's not principle. So the principal purpose of our practice is to work for the benefit of sentient beings, to liberate them from their suffering. That is the aim of our practice. To achieve that, right, understanding the nature of mind, the nature of reality, the nature of self, you know, facilitates that. But the purpose of a bodhisattva is not simply to have meditative insight and to cultivate wisdom. It is to be a loving, compassionate human being who is selflessly, continually, unceasingly working to benefit beings. So again, for those of you who have a little time on your hands and you want something to think about, right? Rather than thinking about all the things we're usually thinking about, maybe we can start thinking about, who can I benefit today? Who can I help today? Who perhaps needs me today? We can begin to think like that. So he begins with ultimate bodhicitta, which is interesting. Because usually you think in a sequential, the teachings on compassion, loving kindness. And since he said earlier on, right, they're kind of more accessible to beginners, right? You'd think he'd begin there, but he begins with ultimate bodhicitta, which I think is very profound. But actually, in the guided meditation today, what I'd like, who is ever doing it, is to begin doing the practices associated with exchanging self and other. And tonight, in tonight's meditation, I'll guide in the ultimate bodhicitta ones. And then tomorrow we'll go more into the relative. So he says, the first section on ultimate bodhicitta is divided into two sections, instruction for the period of meditation, instructions for post-meditation practice. So again, this is, means these are the meditation instructions for on the mat, and these are the post-meditation, or you know, when we get off the mat and go about in the world. Okay? So he says, so now we're into the instructions, the ultimate bodhicitta, on meditation. What he means, on the cushion. Or for those who are sitting on a chair, that also means you too. So we just go back, on the chair meditation. But he means formal practice. So he says, with respect to the first topic, after the practice of Guru Yoga, what's this called, described above, you should sit with the body straight. And as you breathe in and out, count without disturbance 21 breaths over and over again. This exercise will render you a suitable vessel for meditation practice. Okay? Everybody hear that? We need to be a suitable vehicle for meditation practice. You know, when I traveled in Asia, in various Buddhist countries, that most Buddhists do not do meditation. Right? For most Buddhists in Asia, Buddhism is really a kind of a religion, and it is practiced very much like a religion. It may have different religious, some very similar and some different than other religions, but more or less, it's practiced like a religion. And most people, again, do not do meditation. So when you tell people that you are here because you want to learn meditation, their response is, wow, pretty good. And you're a layman. Wow, that's really good. You know, so meditation is not, see, here in America, meditation is like, everybody either does meditation these days or knows that it'd probably be good for them to do. Right? People say, oh yeah, meditation. Yeah, I should probably do that. It'd probably be good for me. Right? I mean, it's like that. It has been taken out of the context in which it usually, thousands of years developed, which is, it is this transformative practice into just another kind of psychological self-help, self-improvement kind of thing, right? Doing meditation, good for me. I could probably handle my stress better. So that is why you're hearing here, in terms of beginning meditation, that we should be a suitable vessel. Right? A suitable vessel. We've become somewhat of a suitable vessel already. We have connected with the lineage. We hold the lineage in our heart. We are aware that we are participating in this transformative journey that, is thousands of years old, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of teachers continuously, right? We have contemplated the four reflections, the mind turnings, so our mind is seeing clearly and our mind has turned to Dharma, right? And now when he talks about, counting the breath, what he's talking about is what's called, many of you may know, the samatha practice, right? Samatha. Samatha is, Thich Nhat Hanh talks about mindfulness, concentration, insight, or mindfulness, stopping, deep looking. So samatha is that practice where we learn how to rest the mind. We learn how to stabilize the mind. This mind, this monkey mind that has run in all directions, anywhere it wants to go, according to causes and conditions, totally undisciplined, and always going. We are learning now to bring it to rest, stability. Right. And again, the practice he refers to here, where he says counting the breaths, 21 breaths, is a practice that we all do, right? Whether it's counting the breath, labeling the breath, observing the breath, it is this practice that stabilizes the mind, quiets the mind, lets the bubbles kind of settle, the sediment settle, as Thich Nhat Hanh says, right? So there is this stability and clarity of mind that is needed before we go on in our meditation practice. So traditionally, samatha, single point of concentration, mental quiescence, calm abiding, it's called different things, it all refers to the same thing, is what we do as the first step in our tradition. Is that clear? It is that makes us a suitable vehicle for the next step of looking into, more deeply into, the nature of phenomena, the nature of mind. But if the mind is, it can't hold on to anything. It can't really investigate anything. It needs a certain degree of stability and concentration if it's going to kind of find its way through the thicket of our conditioned mind and thoughts and feelings and all these things. So there needs to be a settling down. There needs to be an opening up. There needs to be some space, some light within our mind, right? That insight and wisdom can find space to grow. Right. Again, if we don't have that, we may wonder why, I kind of had that moment of clarity, I had that moment of insight, all of a sudden I saw this clearly, but why can't I live it? Because the mind itself, in which that insight is occurring, doesn't have the ground to plant it. There's no stable ground to plant that insight. So it can grow. It's like if you bought your, if your garden was just a mass of shrubs and brambles and weeds and everything's covered over and vines, and you brought home this beautiful plant and you stuck it somewhere in there, you come out a week later, you go, where is that plant? Where is it? It's like, I can't find it. Well, it's because you didn't have any space for it. We have to make space. So the understandings and the insights of deeper Dharma can take root. And so he says, to be a suitable vehicle, not only do we have to have the correct view that the preliminaries give us, but we also need the stability of mind, right, that comes from samatha practice. Is that clear? I mean, he says it very briefly. He says, count the breaths. Count without disturbance 21 breaths over and over again. So this could go on for years. But he's basically, that's the instruction. Now we know, just to say a little more about samatha, traditionally, in the meditative tradition, there are sort of two types of samatha, or single-pointedness of mind. Again, there is the single-pointedness in which we are focused single-mindedly on one object. That's called concentration with an object. An object could be what? An object could be a physical object. Right? I'm going to concentrate on this. Single-mindedly, I'm just going to rest my mind on this, and I'm going to keep it on this. And, it's sort of like all the other senses other than the eyes are unattended to and eventually withdraw, because I'm just going to focus on this single point of concentration. So it can be on a physical object, right? Or it can be on like something in our body, such as our body or such as the breath, right? And traditions, in the Zen tradition, it's more the full breath here, but we know in certain Vipassana traditions, they single-pointedly concentrate on the breath coming in at the tip of their nose, right? Single point of concentration. And then in some traditions, they have mantras, they have sound, they have visualizations, all kinds of things. But again, they're all variations on a theme of single point of concentration, right? So, with an object, something that we can rest the mind on to hold attention to, right? To put our attention on, so the mind begins to stabilize around the object. And out of that, because the mind is not as dispersed and running around as it used to be, there is a calming, there is a quieting, which feels good. So there are many positives that come from samatha, having a mindful, concentrated mind in this way. Okay. Then there is what's called samatha without an object. Right. So in this one, and they're different. In this one, we are gaining again stability and calmness of mind by holding it somewhere. Right. In the formless, it is actually the mind. What is the mode of concentration is just on awareness. That is what is concentrated. That is where our attention is. It is on awareness. And then all the things that arise in awareness, thoughts, feelings, perceptions, as well as physical things, are not grasped at, are not attached to, are not pushed away, or avoided. Okay? It is a similar type of single-mindedness. Did you get it? It's a similar kind of one-mindedness. The mind is now one, but instead of being one single-pointedly on an object, right? All the energies of the mind is one around its own awareness, its own undifferentiated mindfulness. It is aware of things, but it is not following, grasping in any way. Right? It's just resting. In this kind of, is that clear? And they're two different. Those are two different kinds. Obviously, and this is the teachings that I always received for lay people. Since we are so much in the realm of activity, where there is so much going on, the latter concentration is obviously more suited. To our lifestyle, right? Because we do not spend hours and hours and hours and hours a day in cultivating that kind of concentration on an object. Right? We are active. Right? So this second type of cultivation, in a certain way, is more suited to us. The problem is what? Doing it. You know, there are many people you run into, oh, I practice choiceless awareness. That's a phrase people say. And I do this. But, you know, I practice formless meditation. I mean, it sounds good. You know, but you have to have a very strong mind, right? That can really just rest in awareness in a very concentrated way and not be attracted or repulsed by anything that arises. Is that clear? So traditionally, the way I was taught it is one begins with the single-pointed to develop a certain degree of calmness and stability and getting the mind used to being integrated, right? And then you move into the formless, you know, because, or else you could say you're doing but all you're doing is sitting there following your thoughts around. You don't need to meditate for that. We're already doing it. Right? I mean, so don't be impressed by people who say they're doing formless meditation. But again, understand that it is a wonderful thing and something that one can begin to practice with. All right? You could do your, and maybe we'll do some tonight. We've done it. Oh, we've done a lot of it here. You know, that you can be doing, you're more concentrated, and then for a few minutes you just let go and you just come into a more open, aware state. And you see how long you can hold it. So you can kind of get used to it, build up. But again, we'll do some of that tonight. So is that clear? Okay. So he's giving us kind of a sequence for many of us. Some, you know, who've been with me a while know about this, but for some are new, a kind of how to do a meditation. It is a little different. And I remember when I first encountered teachers teaching this, it is very different than what I learned in Zen. Zen was like you sit down and you do it, right? One practice, you know. This is a practice period can have parts, right? A musical analogy could be, you just practice one piece. That's all you work on, one piece. You sit down, you work on the piece, you know, that's all you do. You work on the piece. In this one, you sit down, you do some exercises to warm up, you know what I mean? It's like that. You maybe are in your meditation period, you're perhaps doing three or four different things. It's a whole thing. It's not like you're doing four different things, you know, you're not doing, I'll do a little, invoking the guru, then I'll pray to Mother Mary, then I'll do some Sufi chanting, you know. I mean, there are people like that who call that a practice period, but I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about, you know, things that have coherence. Is that clear? It's not like it's just some kind of hybrid thing that we put together. But again, you can see where you sit. You kind of develop this relationship, you know, the setting within the lineage. You use the archetype of the teacher to kind of have this this thing inside you that is inspirational and motivating, right? Which is what it's about. You do the four reflections, right? You then stabilize yourself in single point of concentration, and then you move for what he calls the actual practice now of ultimate bodhicitta. Is that clear? Good. Now he says, for the actual practice, regard all, this is the first slogan, regard all phenomena as dreams. Anybody ever hear that before? Yeah. Again, it's just one of those little key phrases that has the power to liberate. Right? So, and we will go through it again, even for those of you who have been with me for years and have heard me talk about this ad nauseum. I hope you're not going, here he goes again with his regard all phenomena dreams spiel. But he is. Because it is that essential. Again, this is a very powerful analogy. In our dreams, when we're in the dream, right, it all seems very real. We're real, the other people are real, we see, we hear, we smell, we taste, right? We have the full range of human experience, don't we? Right? When we're in the dream. Right? When we're in the dream, we think everything in the dream that is happening is real, solid. We can actually feel things. We can eat food and go, what? Delicious. Right? I mean, so we, you know, in our dream self eats dream food and has real good feeling, or can get scared, you know, can have a whole range. So the idea is, in the dream, everything seems real, solid, permanent, self-existent, right? I'm real, you're real, everybody in it is real. The world of our senses. We see objects, we hear sounds, we smell smells, we taste, we feel, and with our mind we are aware of thoughts, feelings, and perceptions. This is the world of phenomena. Phenomena here means the world of things. And things means anything of which one of our six senses, and in Buddhism, the mind that cognates is the sixth sense. Right? So, the objects of our senses are what are called, that's phenomena. Right? All the things that we know. Right? And so the instruction is, see them all as dream or dreamlike. Or another way to say it, it's even though we think we're awake, we're still in a dream. Because just like in the dream, we think that everything that appeals to our senses is real, solid, and permanent, and self-existent, don't we? That is not true. That is not what the awakened ones tell us. And that is not one that we can experience ourselves. In the same way that the solidity and permanence and reality of a dream that seems so dreamlike is immediately understood not to be that way when we wake up.